From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in the hot seat today over Benghazi. John Kerry and Chuck Hagel will soon face their own confirmation hearings for state and defense and how they see the world. My guest today says it's the whole American foreign policy grand strategy that needs to be questioned, the large and in charge global titan posture we've had for half a century. This hour On Point, the case for and against pullback and a grand new global strategy for America. You can join the conversation. Is it time to step back, come home, time to drop the global cop routine and work on our own problems here? Time to go light abroad and let the world sort itself out? Or is that too dangerous? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton talking Benghazi this morning before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. In her opening statement, she talked about why the U.S. must stay engaged in the world's hotspots and pretty much everywhere else.
Let me underscore the importance of the United States continuing to lead in the Middle East, in North Africa, and around the world. We've come a long way in the past 4 years, and we cannot afford to retreat now. When America is absent, especially from unstable environments, there are consequences. Extremism takes root, our interests suffer, our security at home is threatened.
There's the diplomatic version. Here's the military version. If you were watching the NFL playoff games last weekend, you may have seen this ad for the U.S. Navy. It's a recruiting campaign. It's like a global force for good. It's been around for a year or so. They ran an ad there. Here's another one that was on the Navy's website. It's recruiting website.
The call to serve has no weight, yet I have held it in my hands. I will commit to carry it close to my heart until my country is safe and the anguish of those less fortunate has been soothed. And for those who choose to answer the call, for their country, for their fellow man, for themselves, it is the most powerful force on earth. America's Navy, a global force for good.
A global force for good. And if you saw the ad during the NFL game, there's a gigantic aircraft carrier, the deck sweeping beneath the camera, chock-a-block full of high-tech military aircraft. There's the global face of the United States on the military side. There's a call for pullback. Joining me now in the studio is Barry Posen, director of the Security Studies Program at MIT. His essay, Pullback, The Case for a Less Activist Foreign Policy, is in the current issue of Foreign Affairs magazine and creating a lot of buzz in foreign policy circles. You can find a link to the essay at our website, onpointradio.org. Barry Posen, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
What's the case you're making?
Well, the United States has had a consensus strategy shared by Republicans and Democrats that centers on U.S. activism, U.S. presence around the world. The strategy made sense when the Soviet Union was a great geostrategic threat. It makes a lot less sense when the Soviet Union is not a big geostrategic threat. So the United States should review the strategy that it's pursued for the last 20 years and ask, really, how well is it doing? And if it's not doing well, why is it not doing well? And with what could we replace it?
As you describe this grand strategy that's been around for a long time now, since the final years of the Cold War and really earlier, it's more than activism and presence. I mean, as you say, the consensus that the United States should dominate the world militarily, economically, and politically. I mean, that's more than just a little activism. That is be the boss.
It is be the boss. And, you know, we have lots of reasons or lots of explanations could be adduced for why the Americans behave this way. One is we do have a lot of power. When states have a lot of power, they tend to be seduced into using it. But second, the United States policy community entertains the idea that international politics can be transformed from a realist struggle for power and security into something else, that if America just presses hard enough, ultimately we'll solve all the world's security problems. We'll democratize, we'll marketize, we'll suppress military competition, and we're going to get to some nirvana-type state. And this is the promise, right? The global force for good. It means we're going to produce enough good at some point that everything's going to be fine. And these are fatuous ideas.
Well, look at that. What have the faces of this grand strategy been to people around the world? How's it been seen, experienced? How's it been projected?
Well, the Americans have their own view, which is we think of it as how, you know, our friends experience it, right? So the Europeans are completely happy with this strategy because it secures them at very low cost to them. We spend nearly 5% of GDP on defense, going down a bit. The Europeans spend perhaps 1.5%. So we're a great insurance policy for them. They love it. Mm-hmm. The Japanese spend 1% of GDP on defense. We're defending them. They love it. So we talk to those allies, they tell us how much they love it. But there are other parts of the world that people don't love it so much, especially the places where we've gone to visit with military power for the purpose of transforming societies. So we were not so popular in Iraq. There are different views about that, but somehow we had to spend as much money in Iraq to get a stalemate as we spent in Vietnam to get a stalemate. And the Iraqis didn't have the Soviets or the Chinese helping them, so the Iraqis really didn't like us very much. And I think we have to accept that the change that we wrought in Iraq was really not particularly great when all is said and done.
Not to mention Afghanistan, Libya, Somalia.
It's a particular part of the world, but especially throughout the Arab world, where we're not much loved, and the Americans engage in a kind of loss chasing activity, which is we keep thinking there's some magical thing we're going to do that's going to make us loved in the Arab world, and it's probably not going to happen. Right? We have a few interests in that part of the world. We should pursue them carefully and cautiously. But the idea that through the injection of a lot of American energy, we're going to make ourselves loved, or that we're going to create stable democracy. I think we've tested this hypothesis. It hasn't worked very well.
But on the other hand, it's so deeply sort of ingrained, imbued in American sense of the world. When we see those ads at the NFL games, giant aircraft carriers, all over the world, projecting American power for good, it doesn't seem odd. It seems normal. It has been the norm. And plenty of people will say, look, we need that. You heard Hillary Clinton say, let me underscore the importance of the United States continuing to lead when America is absent. We just heard in that tape, Barry, especially from unstable environments, there are consequences.
And when America is present, there are consequences. The United States put its pool cue to the billiard balls of Libya, broke that collection of balls, and scattered weapons and terrorists all over that part of the world. When the United States decides to overthrow an autocratic government for the sake of spreading democracy, it should think a little bit about the consequences. I mean, these autocratic governments have often suppressed a lot of internal political competition. They've often amassed huge stocks of weapons. And when you knock over one of these governments, you're creating quite a lot of trouble for yourself.
The president said,
and if you go and try and manage the situation after you've knocked it over, I think we have evidence of how that goes in Iraq. I mean, first, it's the old pottery barn rule that General Powell decide if you break it, you own it. Mm-hmm. Well, we broke it. We owned it. We spent billions of dollars and thousands of lives trying to glue it back together. The Iraqis themselves took the opportunity to have vicious civil war, which killed tens of thousands of Iraqis. So our presence was far from an unalloyed good. Sure, Saddam Hussein's an awful guy. I'm not sorry that he's gone. Right, but this notion that there's a surefire solution that comes with American engagement is simply not supported by the evidence.
What have the costs been, monetary and otherwise, to this country of supporting this grand strategy of global dominance?
Well, there's a lot of different costs. First is just the cost of the wars. If something is happening in the world, and interestingly, it's a consequence of one of the good things that, say, the Hillary Clintons of the world might claim, which is we have a world of free trade and globalization and movement of information and all the rest, investment and expanding markets. But this means expanding skills, expanding capabilities, the diffusion of power, right? This is a fundamental question that needs to be answered. How did the United States spend, in real terms, as much money on the Iraqi insurgency as it spent on the Vietnam War? How did we achieve that? It happened for one reason, right? Which is the locals are simply much more capable than they once were.
Are you suggesting that by securing some kind of general Pax Americana, we've enabled a free flow of ideas that is redounded to our to our detriment?
I don't even think it's possible to talk about detriment. I think that we've helped create a change in the world over the last 50 years.
Isn't it the
and
change,
change
you sought, a more open?
That change has been good for many people and produced many good things. But we also have to understand the other unintended consequences of those changes and adapt ourselves to those unintended consequences. And one of them is there's a lot more capability out there in the world.
What does that mean? Bring our money home and invest it in training here? Or you're up against tougher foes when you go there?
There's nothing you can do about that world you created other than try and take advantage of it. Trade, invest, do whatever you can. What I'm saying is you have to look at the military and security implications of it. And the military and security implications of it is that the United States is not the big dog it once was.
So you're saying we can't police it anymore? We shouldn't?
You can't police it the way you policed it before. You can't police it as much. You can't transform societies. There are things you should do. My strategy talks about U.S. basic national interests and what we need to do to pursue those basic national interests. My strategy talks about a much reduced U.S. military, but not a zero U.S. military.
We'll look at that strategy. Yeah, but maybe Americans want to police the world. George McGovern, this was decades ago, now he said, come home, America. Zip for him. Almost nothing in the presidential election.
I think we need to understand that we have the same problem in our foreign policy as we have in our domestic policy, which Americans in principle want many things that they're not actually willing to pay for, right? So we borrow for these wars, right? We don't want to pay the high casualty of these wars, so we borrow more money to substitute capital for labor. We feel guilty about the soldiers we sent to these wars, so we borrow more money to provide additional pay and benefits for these soldiers, right? So the notion that this is intensively supported by the American people, I think it's belied by the fact that the U.S. government never asked the American people to sacrifice for these goals.
Very Posen, hold the thought right there. The big piece is Pullback, the case for a less activist foreign policy, a new grand strategy for America. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about the call for a new, dramatically more modest foreign policy for the United States, an end to the global domination grand strategy, a new posture, a lower, less expensive profile in the world. You heard talk of talking with foes in the president's second inaugural address this week, but also you heard a lot of what has been the theme of the American grand strategy for half a century. Here was the president.
America will remain the anchor of strong alliances in every corner of the globe. And we will renew those institutions that extend our capacity to manage crisis abroad. For no one has a greater stake in a peaceful world than its most powerful nation. We will support democracy from Asia to Africa, from the Americas to the Middle East, because our interests and our conscience compel us to act on behalf of those who long for freedom.
From Asia to Africa, Americas to the Middle East, because of our interests and our conscience. The president there this week in his second inaugural address. Barry Posen is with us. His big piece in Foreign Affairs magazine is Pullback, the case for a less activist foreign policy. We're going to hear pushback to that in a moment. So what would this look like, Barry Posen? This new grand strategy, more modest, less out there, what would it look like?
I think the first thing we need to do is take a look at the allies who are fully capable of looking after themselves and asking ourselves the question of why we're continuing to look after them. I mean, Europe is rich. Europe is safe. The Americans had a great success with the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, a great success in containing the Soviet Union.
So bring the troops home from Europe and
over.
Japan. What is it, 180,000 or something?
Japan is a separate issue. Mm-hmm. But certainly in Europe, I think we can afford to much greater reductions in troops. And I think we need to change the whole structure of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. The military organization that's attached to NATO should just simply be handed back to the Europeans. The Supreme Allied Commander Europe should be
off
a European.
Off you go, boys. Okay.
And the alliance should basically go back to what it was when it was originally conceived, which was simply a political alliance.
Okay,
right? The military part came later. It's one fairly significant
mm-hmm.
piece. Second, in the Middle East Persian Gulf area, I think we have to make decisions about what really matters to us and what we can do. And I think one of the biggest choices we have to confront, and we're confronting it now, we're going to continue to have to confront, is what is our role in the internal politics of Arab countries and in social and political transformations within those countries.
It has seemed rather slight.
And I think it has to stay slight.
So that's not a change, is it?
Well, wait a second. We helped knock over the regime in Libya. We're having an argument about whether to help knock over the regime in Syria. We knocked over a regime in Iraq, right?
And we're
in business defending a lot of other regimes, right?
Bahrain, Egypt for a long time.
Saudi Arabia.
Right?
So we have to decide exactly what it is we need to do there and what it is we probably can't do there. And I think that this is a kind of below the radar kind of set of conversations which we're barely having in this country, and that is, are we ever going to be in the peacekeeping counterinsurgency business in the Arab world again? And I think the answer is no, under no circumstances.
Okay, but does that mean pull back? I mean, we're still in there in a big way diplomatically, as you say, and we've got all kinds of forces around the Persian Gulf.
So second,
Straits of Hormuz.
It means much reducing U.S. forces in the Persian Gulf, right? U.S. forces in the Persian Gulf are really there to defend countries from other countries, and they're really there at this point to defend Arab countries from Iran.
That's flow of oil.
That's what they're.
Isn't that the bottom line?
It's all about the flow of oil. It's all about the flow.
That oil,
of
a lot of it comes to us and our allies.
No, very little of it comes to us. A lot of it goes to our allies. Very little of it comes to us, and less is going to come to us. We're defending oil because of its utility to others, not because of its utility to us.
We don't have a security interest in keeping the Strait of Hormuz open.
There's a globe. You got to be careful with these things. There's a global oil market. If the straits are closed, the global price of oil goes up. It's bad for the economy, et cetera, et cetera. That's all true. So keeping the straits open is in our interest. Ensuring that that there's no oil hegemon in the Persian Gulf, which is, say, in this case, Iran doesn't succeed at becoming a hegemon in the Persian Gulf. Mm-hmm. Those are all in our interest. The United States doesn't have to have huge forces on the ground to protect these interests. These are basically naval and air problems, right? And the presence of those forces on the ground helps make enemies, domestic enemies to the United States, right, in terms of political currents within the country, and it commits us implicitly to help defend those regimes from their internal problems. And I don't think the United States wants to be a part of that.
If we weren't in there, what would happen? I mean, you heard Hillary Clinton today saying if the U.S. isn't there, things get ugly in a hurry.
I already suggested to you that this is a two-edged sword. If we are there, things get ugly in a hurry too, because people take their ugliness out on us. Right, our presence is not loved by others.
But is your suggestion that people would work it out for themselves if they didn't think, you know, Big Daddy, Big Cop was going to come in?
There's two issues here. Their domestic politics has to take whatever course it's going to take. Our interest is about their security situation relative to outsiders. Our interests are very limited, right? As you said, right, to the extent that there are interests, it's about the flow of oil from the Gulf, and it's about avoiding Iranian hegemony in the Gulf. And there are many ways to skin a cat, and there are many ways for us to pursue this strategy, and getting ever more deeply in bed with these Arab regimes is not necessarily the most intelligent way to pursue that strategy.
If the U.S. globally lightened its footprint along the lines that you outline in your big essay, Pullback, how much could we cut from American military spending? How much would it save us in annual outlays?
Well, different people have different ideas about this. The work that I've done, I think it's something like a quarter to a third. You could get a cut of between a quarter and a third.
So we're talking many hundreds of billions here.
Could be $150 billion, something like that.
Okay.
Could be that much, maybe a bit more. You know, these figures are squishy because we're talking about years. We're talking about decades. We're talking about a growing GDP. We're talking about military costs that always seem to go up. So it's
But that's a money savings. And on top of that, you're saying it would actually be a security savings because...
Yeah, I prefer to think in terms of force structure cuts, right? Mm-hmm. And because I don't believe the United States should be in the counterinsurgency business anymore, and there aren't many land threats in the world that where there's one country getting ready to conquer another that is an interest of ours, my biggest cuts fall on the Army, and I would cut the Army in half. Right, smaller cuts fall on the Navy. I cut the Navy by a quarter, cut the Air Force by a quarter in terms of force structure.
And would the world be a calmer place without what you see sometimes as the American provocation, would it be a mess and we just wouldn't care?
I think calmer place is not the correct way to talk about these things. The world is not a calm place now. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be a calm place then. The question is a question of American interests. What are American interests? What does America need to do for its core security purposes? What is the core security situation in the United States? We haven't discussed in this conversation what are the essential facts of the American strategic position. The president says we're not secure unless we're everywhere. everywhere. Now, how is it possible that a country that's the richest, most capable economy in the world and is destined to remain one of the top two or three economies in the world, with a huge resource base on its own continent, protected on the east and west by vast oceans, bordered on the north and south by weak and pliant states,
Canada,
possessed
Mexico.
Of a huge military capability and possessed of nuclear weapons, how is it this country isn't inherently one of the most secure countries that ever existed in the world?
Barry Posen looking to reorient our thinking, the nation's thinking about the country's grand strategy today. We'll hear pushback in just a moment. A couple of calls first. Elaine in Omaha, Nebraska. Elaine, you're on the air.
Good. Hello, Tom. First of all, we have a multi-trillion-dollar debt that we can't seem to resolve, and about $3 trillion of that is due to the Iraq War, according to a Nobel Prize economist, I think his name is Stiglitz. And we have so many problems here that we always say we can't address because we don't have the money. So why are we spending about 50% of our budget on military endeavors, which only create more enemies for us around the world? Seems like to me what we ought to do is increase our tiny little expenditure for foreign aid. It's only about 1% of our budget, and do health, education, and microfinance programs around the world so that we build friendships and solve a lot of those problems that are causing wars in third world countries.
So change that profile, you say. Keep an eye on our debt. Figure out how to bring down the cost of being out there in such an expensive way. Elaine, thanks for that. Let me get one more. Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Daniel's calling. Daniel, you're on with Barry Posen.
Thanks, Tom. I just wanted to respond to something your guest had said earlier about the military, American military presence being in hopes to create some sort of utopian society. I don't agree. I think really, at least what should be, our presence should be more of a, in response to a moral duty of these resources that we have, I think, that we enjoy as a result of taking advantage of the power that we have.
Are you saying a moral duty to spread freedom, democracy? What exactly, Daniel?
Yeah, exactly. These basic human rights that that everyone should enjoy. Sam Harris in his book The Moral Landscape describes these moral axioms that are just basic and human. Life
and is it the job of the United States to you know, go in and fight for those around the world? Is that your basic position, Daniel?
Well, yeah, I believe because of the position that we have, you know, the power that we have that is enjoyed by us because of the way we take advantage of the entire, you know, global economy. I think we have a moral duty to use the resources that we have to help others in the most basic way.
Daniel, I appreciate your call. I mean, President Obama, in his inaugural speech, second inaugural again this week, kind of seconding that with a reference to Martin Luther King, where he was saying, you know, no one is really free unless everybody is free. That's got global implications. On the other hand, Martin Luther King was very critical of American spending in Vietnam. It gets tricky in a hurry. Barry Posen is with me in the studio from MIT. His essay is Pullback, the Case for a Less Activist Foreign Policy. I want to bring into our conversation right now from Hanover, New Hampshire, William Woolforth. He co-authored a rebuttal to Barry Posen's big essay. It also runs in the current issue of Foreign Affairs magazine. He co-authored it with Stephen Brooks and John Eikenberry. It's titled Lean Forward, not Pullback, but Lean Forward in Defense of American Engagement. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. William Woolforth, thank you very much for being with us today.
That's nice to be here, Tom.
So begin your rebuttal. Barry Posen looks around the world, and you hear his case. It's very expensive to be out there the way we have, and it may create more problems than it solves. We need to pull back. You say lean forward still. Why?
Oh, it's a great debate, and we owe a lot of debt to Barry Posen for raising it. But if you think about the questions he raises, I think you'll come to the conclusion that the core of the strategy continues to be in America's interest. And we need to stress what that core is. The core is a series of security guarantees to partners and allies around the world, as a result of which bad things that could happen don't happen. We make the world more secure, making it better for the United States over the long run by making our partners less likely to take actions which would lead to their neighborhoods and ultimately to the world being less secure.
What do you mean by that? What do you mean by that, Bill? How does that work? Security guarantees, therefore less trouble. Why?
Well, take an example. Say Japan. The United States and Japan have a security treaty, which we renewed after the end of the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of that, Japan, yes, as Barry Posen says, only spends 1% of its GDP on defense, but also doesn't do a lot of other things that it would probably do if it felt less secure. It probably would want to have its own nuclear weapons. It would probably want to have a much more capable military. And the result would be fear and concern among its neighbors, in particular China, but also countries like South Korea. And the result could well be an East Asia back in a world of much more intense security competition.
Military buildup, competition, fear.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So the tricky thing about this debate is that a lot of the good things that we see about the world, a lot of security that that Barry Posen talks about, may well be the result of these commitments that we've made. So the strategy in many ways is preventing a worse world from emerging. The strategy that we have now is the kind of the devil we know, and we see its problems, and yes, its expenses, and yes, sometimes it goes overboard in its expectations about what can be done. But what you don't see is the world that would emerge if we seriously pulled back, by which I mean revoking or dramatically scaling back these core security commitments.
Well, let me just
partners.
Ask on that, if I may probe on that, William Walforth. I mean, we've certainly had trouble with this strategy. We've seen wars that have gone in very, very difficult and extremely costly directions. It's not as though it's been all sweetness and light under this policy. And we've seen our military spending just, I mean, awfully high, maybe not the highest it's been in history as a percentage of GDP, but crazy high compared to anybody else. So it already seems troubled and very expensive, does it not?
It does, but partly the ramp up in defense spending occurring after 2001 is the result of a particular response to the challenge of al-Qaeda-style terrorism that the country attempted to implement. And that ended up in, yes, very expensive wars and partly an increase in defense expenditures to the current level. By all estimates, including even those of Governor Romney when he was running for president, these expenditures are going to come down as we exit the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan to a level of defense spending of around – probably most people expect it will end up being around 3.5% of GDP, which is pretty low by historical standards.
And the argument that simply by being out there, you say we're preventing worse things from happening, Barry Posen says, you know what? We're actually provoking a lot of thorny things that happen. We create a lot of resentment. Part of the reason al-Qaeda went after the United States in 2001 was the presence, bin Laden always said, of American troops in Saudi Arabia. What about that? Do we create more trouble than we solve or prevent?
I think it's a end of the day, we get more benefits than costs. As I say, many of the costs are observable and some of the benefits aren't observable. But still, at the end of the day, the question to ask yourself is, we came out of the Cold War with a large network of alliances and partnerships, good relationships with countries that help us do things in the world, help us cooperate to solve problems that are in our mutual interest. The question is, these things are like assets. Do you want to keep them or do you want to throw them away? In general, I view the world as, yes, a place that's potentially dangerous in the future, and I'd like to sustain these alliances. I'd like to sustain these partnerships rather than get rid of them, bearing in mind that they do sometimes generate costs. Our allies sometimes are not the perfect allies we would wish that would obey every single thing we would like them to do and also spend more and more on defense. It is imperfect. It creates management problems. You have your Benghazis. You have your Senate hearings where you have American officials grilled for all the problems. And sometimes it seems like wouldn't it be better just to get away from all that, just come home. At the end of the day, I'm convinced that the benefits dramatically outweigh the cost.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the call for a new, dramatically more modest foreign policy for the United States, an end to the global domination grand strategy, a new posture, lower, less expensive profile in the world. Barry Posen makes the case in the current issue of Foreign Affairs magazine. His essay is Pullback, the Case for a Less Activist Foreign Policy. And it comes at a time when we're seeing big turnover in the Obama administration on lots of security fronts. You can link to his essay at our website, onpointradio.org. And there's a rebuttal. William Walforth is one of the co-authors there. He's with us right now from Dartmouth College. The rebuttal titled Lean Forward in Defense of American Engagement. You can link to that one on our website as well. Lots of response online. Gary says, kind of to your point, Barry, says, get over World War II. It was a fluke of history that the U.S. did some good there. Get rid of the whole idea of U.S. exceptionalism. Stop killing people. John says, if we have a new foreign policy that precludes perpetual military involvement in global bases, what would happen to our base economy? We're going to make washing machines and TV sets again? LOL, pipe dream. The bankers would never stand for that. Greg says, though, look around. He says, Iran and North Korea are on the verge of nukes. There's a new generation of radicalism sweeping through the Middle East. Al-Qaeda reemerging. We've had embassies breached, murder of diplomats, hostages killed in mayhem looking at Algeria. It says President Obama didn't address any of it, but he harkens back to JFK in his inaugural address, maybe laying down the base for the strategy you're not so keen on now, Barry, but where JFK said, let every nation know we will pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe to assure the survival and success of liberty. That sounds large and in charge. Wayne in Acton, Massachusetts, you're on the air with Barry Posen and Bill Walforth.
I agree with Barry Posen. I think it is time to pull back. You know, I'm a Vietnam-era veteran myself. My concern is the concern that was expressed by one of your emailers, which is, you know, our military, our Defense Department, these are job creators. And, you know, even here in Massachusetts, when there was the likelihood of General Electric losing a jet engine contract, I think it was for the F-22.
Okay.
Our own Senator Kerry was very upset about that.
Sure.
And I think that represents tremendous resistance to pulling back. You know, all these bases, all the jobs associated with them will be, I think, a lot of resistance to the pullback notion.
Let us pick up that point, Wayne, and thank you for your call. Barry Posen, Wayne's for it. He's for the pullback, but he says you will gut our economy as it is.
Well, I think, you know, there's a larger issue here. I mean, there's two questions. Was the wisdom of my strategy and the question of what is the political saleability of the strategy in the United States?
Mm-hmm.
What would make the country adopt it?
And well, not, and in this case, economic viability,
yeah,
Wayne
economic
raises.
The United States has so many unmet needs, right, that would employ all kinds of high-tech workers, all kinds of construction workers. The amount of
Really? If that's true, why aren't they doing those jobs right now?
Because we're spending the money on something else. We can't get giant infrastructure budgets. Economists,
Corporate America has money stacked up to the ceiling.
Tom,
it's not spending on those other jobs.
We have huge public infrastructure investments to make. That's no different effect on the economy than a dollar spent in the defense
sector.
So
you're talking federal funds.
So we're spent that. Mm-hmm. Where is the ultimate source of the dollar that's spent in defense industry? It's the federal
mm-hmm.
budget.
Mm-hmm.
So highways, railroads, airports, rebuilding our energy infrastructure.
Go high tech there instead of on the deck of an aircraft carrier.
There's a lot of good places mm-hmm. to spend a federal dollar. That's
mm-hmm.
that's not an issue, right? So I'm not the principal concern. Now there is a different way to think about it, which is you have large institutions that are dug in and make their money off military production, and those folk are going to
communities
and those jobs. Those folk are great supporters of an activist grand strategy because it's in their interest, and somebody else may make the money in a different different kind of
so people will yelp about it. Bill Walforth, does this factor into your resistance to this new strategy that it upends the economy as it is today, or you don't really care about that?
Oh, no, I do care about it. But I think the big question really is when you have a country that's got a long-term strategy that's been working, the country's extremely successful, as Barry Posen rightly says, is it likely that you're going to convince a lot of people to simply take a big experiment? Let's try something radically different. Let's completely pull back from the world. Let's revoke a lot of these security commitments and let's see what happens.
Well, we've done it before. We moved in a huge way that was ahistorical for the United States, avoiding, you know, entangling commitments and all that.
We did it, and it didn't turn out so well. I just don't think it's that unusual that politicians are reluctant to run that experiment. I don't need to turn to special economic interests or the entrenched bureaucracies mm-hmm. or political special interests to explain why careful leaders with the best interests of the country at heart should decide to stick with a strategy? Should society hold on to partnerships and alliances around the world?
But surely entropy itself isn't an argument for this. Just because we've done it for a long time now in a very big way, surely that can't mean that we don't learn as we go and change, even radically, if that's suggested by reality.
Definitely, if it's suggested by reality. For example, if it were really the case that we couldn't afford it, if you just could not afford it, of course you'd have to do something else. But we obviously can afford it. I don't think anybody thinks that we can't. And then the question
I don't know
is,
about that. I mean, everybody's howling about debt in Washington. The military budget's a big piece of it.
Well, we have a debt because we spend a lot of money that we refuse to finance.
Including on the military.
Including on the military, although actually that is as a part, but it's only a part of the problem. The reason the country has a budget deficit is because it has the political system has been unwilling to extract the revenues necessary to pay for its current consumption. The largest piece of that is various entitlements, but part of it is also defense. I don't think anyone thinks that the country is incapable of sustaining a strong defense and also sustaining its commitments to its population in old age. That's really a domestic political question.
Well it is, but that is actively debated right now. I must say, I want to get another caller here. Gary in Middletown, Rhode Island. Gary, you're on the air.
Tom, hi. Okay, hi. In large part, I agree with Mr. Posen, in large part. But there's a model for us, and you've touched on it too, and it's been scraped on a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
After the First World War, we mobilized, we got involved, we tipped it in the direction we wanted to tip it in, and then we demobilized. We got uninvolved. A few years later, our incredibly sophisticated European cousins, I'm sure they're sophisticated because that's their opinion about us, we're not, completely got the world in a huge mess. We shut down everything. We quit making Buicks. We started making tanks, put the women in the factories, put the men into uniform, and we went off and we settled things down.
World War II. Okay.
World War II. The World War II is what, and then after that, you ask, why are we in NATO? Why are we here? Why are we there? Because if we're not there, we, for better or worse, we are the guarantors of what passes for peace nowadays, and for sure stability in the world. It is us. How can anyone have any level of confidence that we will not have to do the same thing again if things get enormously out of balance?
Gary, that is the big question I'm sure comes to many people's minds. We'll put it straight to Barry Posen.
Well, I mean, the United States may have to do it again if things become grossly out of balance. But the question is, in what parts of the world today is there a risk of things becoming grossly out of balance, right? Does anyone seriously look at Europe today and think, oh, geez, this is a place that's teetering on the edge of a third or a fourth world war? It's not, right? There are a bunch of countries of modest size, many of them defended with nuclear weapons. And there's no great risk there. And I think we're intelligent enough to be able to tell where in the world there's a risk of things going to hell.
Europe,
and where they
look
are.
At Japan and China. They've been in each other's teeth just in the last few weeks.
I think that's right. And so this raises a different set of questions, right? Which is, I mean, Bill seems to think that the world is going swimmingly with all of this American presence. Well, the Asia that I look at is an Asia that doesn't look like it's going so swimmingly. So all of these things are two-edged swords. American alliances, and the Americans are crazy concerned about the credibility of their commitments to allies. So we work really hard to make them credible. We ask what the allies want. We give them what they want.
Well,
we
if you're going to have them, they ought to be credible, right? If you're going to have them.
Right, but it's not just making them credible to our adversaries. It's making them credible to our allies. And our allies just pretend to us that they're desperately concerned. Free riders. So here we are having a debate in this country about huge cuts, right, in spending on our people, right?
Yeah.
But we're going to continue to spend lots of resources on defense so that Europeans and Japanese can continue to spend money on their people. This is a transfer payment. This is welfare for the rich. The United States defense budget is welfare for the rich.
For other rich countries. Bill Warfoss, what do you say to that, Bill?
It's more complicated than that. Look, we came out of the end of the Cold War with a very, very potent military establishment, a lot of assets in the world. And we decided, hey, we said to our allies, hey, look, why don't we hold on to these assets? We do this really well. And we'll handle some of the high-end military stuff. You guys do some of the other stuff. I admit there may be a trace of free riding here or there, but if you really look at some of these cases, you'll find actually the Allied contribution is pretty substantial. It just shows up in less headline-grabbing ways than the high-tech air power that the United States dominates. For example, if you measure the contribution of allies, for example, in Afghanistan, as controlling for the size of these countries, the number of casualties suffered and the monetary costs controlled for the size of these countries, it turns out the distribution of burdens is relatively fair. Similarly, after the Balkan Wars of the 1990s, we did a lot of the high-end headline-grabbing airstrikes. The Europeans later came in and did the boring work of peacekeeping and democracy building and police
enough,
force
but, building. You still do have that number of the U.S. spending more than everybody else put together, you know, way down the list of nations. Our time grows short, and I wish it weren't. Larry in Scarborough, Maine. Larry, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, guys. I am a true Libra. I am in agreement with both of your guests.
Okay.
First of all, I'd love to see us come back home. And yes, I'm sure we would find other places to spend our money, such as infrastructure and teachers and nurses and so on. As for your other guest, your New Hampshire guest, says, you know, if we're not there, there's more turmoil. I kind of agree with that. I would love to see, for example, in Syria, where the heck is the United Arab League? You know, the Arabs, they want to be leaders. They want to be respected. Come on. You can't even handle one of your own countries murdering 60,000 of its own people.
Larry, our time is short. Let me pick it up right there. Barry Posen, you hear the call. If we weren't there, and we're not in Syria, but the Arab League isn't either, would other coalitions step up to kind of keep the peace if the U.S. weren't there on the block?
First of all, I think we have to return the discussion to America's national interests, right? Mm-hmm. So often these discussions elide what the United States needs for its security and what are some of the benefits that others have accrued from things that the United States
does. So lay down the core.
So we have to ask what the core is for us. And many places may experience conflict, whether we're present or whether we're not. But those conflicts do not affect the United States' national security very much. Now, there are a few core areas in the world where the Americans need to continue to pay attention.
Name them.
And Bill and I agree. Asia is one of them, right?
That's half the world.
Of course it's half the world, but there's another half that maybe we could pay less attention to. And within Asia, we need to cut new deals, right? This whole pivot to Asia thing is way more energetic than it needs to be. And we've seen the consequence, right? So the Americans make a great show of how we're going to send some Marines to Australia.
Hillary Clinton's in every country. That's right.
So what do the Australians do? They cut their defense spending. The Japanese claim to be really, really scared of the Chinese, and they're having this conflict over these stupid little islands, right? Which somehow we're committed to defend, right?
Specs.
And so the Japanese announced a big increase in their defense spending. It was $1 billion. This is next to nothing, right? So we need to pursue our interests in Asia. We need to keep a watchful eye on China. We also need to be conscious of the fact that China is going to be a partner great power, and we're not going to just be able to tell them how it's going to be.
They're going to take over if we pull back? They're going to be the world hegemon?
No, they're not going to be the world hegemon. We're moving in the direction of a multipolar world. There's not going to be a global hegemon. Now, the Americans could admit this now. And
that's okay. We can come home, stick to our knitting, and be better off, you're saying.
You don't have a – Bill thinks you have a choice. Right? Mm-hmm. I don't think you really have a choice. I think the direction of change in terms of the distribution of global power is towards a multipolar world. It's slow, it's incremental, but I think it's going to happen.
The United States
needs to find a new way to pursue its interests, right, in a world in which there are several countries whose interests need to be accommodated in a serious way, not countries who are being asked not so politely to sign up and join our world, the world that we create.
Do you see any sign of this coming? Obama just gave an inaugural address. We quoted from it. It sounded like the old strategy. There's John Kerry lined up for State Department. There's Chuck Hagel lined up for the Pentagon. Do you see real evidence of this emerging?
I think there's slow, incremental adaptation in the American foreign policy and security elite to the fact that our capabilities are not what they were. And if you want to see evidence of it, just read the Financial Times and look at how much whining there is among the Europeans about what they perceive to be the direction of American change, which is they're the first place that we're going to that we have shaved and we're going to shave it more. Right? The Middle East, it's anybody's guess, but I think the president's reticence about being involved involved in Syria is driven by the hard-won lessons of Iraq and Afghanistan.
Bill Walforth, pay any price, bear any burden, or something new emerging here?
A smarter version of the strategy. Exactly as happened after Vietnam. The United States learned a lesson. Hey, we're not going to adopt that quite that expansive approach to remaking the world, the Nirvana utopia stuff you mentioned at the outset of the program, and instead focus on the essentials. And the essentials are maintaining those partnerships so that if things go south, you've got you've got someone to rely on. Somebody answers the phone when you call. Coming out is easy. Getting back in is a lot harder. Maintain those partnerships. Keep them going. Keep these collaborations going in order to manage and cooperate for the good of, yes, the world, but mainly the United States. Don't chuck them out the window. So I think you can see a leaner, meaner, smarter strategy that keeps the fundamentals in place.
It is exciting to live in a time when these things are being discussed. It's been a long time since we've had such a deep conversation about the roots of our global grand strategy. We're very grateful to the two of you for helping us do it. William Walforth at Dartmouth College, co-author of Lean Forward in Defense of American Engagement. Bill, thank you very much for being with us today.
And thank you, Tom.
And Barry Posen, professor of political science at MIT, director of the Security Studies Program there, author of Pullback, The Case for a Less Activist Foreign Policy. Check it out at our website. Barry Posen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be here.
Coming up tomorrow, we're going to look at Boeing and its Dreamliners grounded all over the place, where global air travel goes on the other side of Boeing's problems. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.